You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about building sustainable caskets and natural or green burials.
First, Governor Walker recently signed a suite of bills aimed at preventing child abuse and the exploitation of children online. Republican State Senator Rob Cole sponsored two of the bills in that package, legislation aimed at preventing abuse of children with disabilities and another enacting tougher penalties for repeat child abuse offenders.
Senator Coles joins us now. Senator Coles, welcome to Central Time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Before we get into your specific legislation, it seems like there was a lot of action related to protecting children from abuse and exploitation. Was this a conscious effort by legislators?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think some of it has to do with the Attorney General. When he came in, he had a group of ideas, and my office worked with him on a package of four bills, and two of them made it through the process, and I think he was involved in some of these other things like human trafficking, et cetera, but I think that played a big role, and I think the Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, in his agenda. But, you know, the advocacy groups, like in the case of this bill, Senate 325, the advocacy groups were part of that, and Assembly Bill 667 relating to having protocols for reporting of any incidents against disabled kids. That came from the advocacy groups.
Well, and then let's start with that piece of legislation aimed at protecting children with disabilities. What kind of things are provided for in this legislation that was just signed into law?
Here's the overall problem. The advocacy groups suspect that disabled kids are being physically abused at a higher level than non-disabled kids, which is hard to get our arms around. It's tragic to think about it, but apparently that's what's happening. So what we're trying to do in this bill is develop protocols so all the parts of the state, you know, whether it's an agency, a government agency, or a nonprofit group that's contracting with state government, would report all the same kinds of information. And the idea behind that is that we can dissemble that at some point and try to make some changes. I mean, is this a baby step? I guess some people might say it is. But we've got to have the same kinds of information reported all over the state. And that's what we're trying to do. So the bill says the Department of Children and Families would come up with so-called model procedures in the investigation of reports of suspect or threatened abuse or neglect of a child with a disability. And they would, one, you've got to ask, was it a disabled kid? Two, what kind of disabilities does the child have? It would come up with recommendations on how to deal with interviews. These are the kind of things that the legislation asked for, and it's not limited to that. So we're just trying to come up with a protocol. I call it a protocol, set a standard, so every part of the state, every group that's involved in this would be giving similar data. And then we'll go from there after that's done. But it's quite tragic to think that disabled kids are being abused at a higher level.
So it sounds like you're trying to get a handle on the scope of this problem.
There's
suspicion among advocates that this is happening. We're trying to get a handle on how widespread this is.
Right. And it could be, the type of disabled kids. It could be a certain age. We're not sure, but there's problems out there, and until we have these protocols on detailed reporting across the state required by statute, so this would be a rule that would come out of the Department of Children and Families, and then it would go through the respective standing committees in the Senate and the Assembly, be approved, and then they would have to comply with it. So it's one of these things where we hope this leads to better outcomes, but until we've actually gone through it, we won't know.
And then the hope here would be you get this apples-to-apples data from around the state, everybody working with the same standards, and then that could be used either by you in the legislature for future action or maybe right. by law enforcement or social workers?
Could be all of the above. All of the above.
We're talking
but
to...
Disabled Rights Wisconsin, this was their idea. So we worked with them to come up with this legislation. Representative Clayfish from the southern part of the state was the assembly author. And this bill, if you look at the authors, it was very much a bipartisan bill. It was a mixture of Democrats and Republicans.
Talking to Wisconsin State Senator Rob Coles about new legislation just signed into law aimed at preventing child abuse here in the state. And let's get into the other piece of legislation you sponsored on repeated child abuse. What changes under this new law?
Here's what's happening here. Several years ago, the legislature passed laws on repeated sexual abuse, and at the time we should have also made it for repeated physical abuse. Because here's what's happening. You've got very young kids, and they can't remember when something happened. So what we would do here is say that for the prosecutors, if they could prove a range of time and at least three episodes, even though without knowing the exact date and time, they could prosecute someone to a much higher level and put them away for a longer period of time. This is another one of these quite tragic situations where, you know, this is not just disabled kids. This is all kids that are being abused in one way or the other. And the Attorney General, when he came into office, pointed out that this is a flaw in the law because you had to pinpoint, in order to have the strong penalties, you had to pinpoint the exact date and time. Well, these little kids are not going to remember that. So what this allows is a range and a stronger penalty. So it's a penalty enhancer if the prosecutor, you know, going to the jury can show that there's been multiple, at least three offenses. So it's very similar to what we did with sexual abuse, but now this would be physical abuse. It's quite hard for me to grasp how any of these kids could be abused, but it's happening, and the prosecutors, and you know, our attorney general, was a former prosecutor, and he found this to be a loophole when he was trying to prosecute some of these very bad people that were doing this to our kids.
And how big is the enhancement of the punishment in these cases?
It would double the time in prison. So you're talking, you know, 3 years to like 6 years. Now, whether is this going to work? It's another one of these things where it'll have to play out over a period of time. The Attorney General thinks that this will be significant. I'll take him at his word. You know, we did this bill for him. Again, this was quite a bipartisan kind of a piece of the legislation. If you look at the authorship, there's people from both sides of the aisle were all over the bill.
We'll leave it there for now. Senator Coles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Have a nice day.
Rob Coles is a Republican state senator in Wisconsin, serving Wisconsin's 2nd District. He joins us to talk about new child abuse prevention legislation recently signed into law.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at possible media mergers in the works and what it all means for news consumers.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Jonas Zahn didn't plan to make a career in casket making, but the death of his grandfather opened his eyes to the funeral industry and launched him on a new path towards sustainability after death.
When my grandfather passed away, over a course of 3 days, I worked with my brother and sister and my father and my mom, and we made a casket for Grandpa. And that was a really different emotional experience. It's not something I planned or anticipated, but it really moved all of us. We spent time together, we talked about Grandpa, and we did something that we all felt very proud, which got me interested in casketry. Before my grandfather died, and some things I realized with that experience is how disconnected I was from death. So I actually got to go to my grandfather's house, and I experienced his deceased body before a funeral service. I realized that's the only time in my whole life, unless you're in a medical or emergency rescue profession, we don't really encounter a deceased body, whether it's someone we know or not. And that's unusual. That's a very contemporary thing. And I thought that, wow, that's a really neat experience, and that's something I think other families would benefit from. So in the beginning, I really wanted to make a modest or humble and low-impact, earth-friendly type of casket. Everything here, everything we make, is made in Wisconsin by Wisconsin hands and craftsmen from Wisconsin woods. What we're standing in used to be a funeral home. It was a funeral home for about 40 years, and it was a furniture store before that, which is very common. Funeral homes and furniture stores were very often cohabitating businesses. So every casket shelf comes in here, and this was an old furniture store, so it has an old freight lift. And it's a hand-operated lift with a rope and a big pulley and a cable. That's the brakes. So they come out the elevator, and we come in here into the finish room.
Hi.
But we are in a room right now that's about 60 feet long and I think 16 feet wide, which allows us to line up at all of our caskets that are in different states of finishing in a row here. And I think we have just shy of 30 in progress here right now. I mean, this shape is really interesting. If you close your eyes and say casket, and the shape that comes to mind, maybe steel, maybe wood, but it has an arched lid, has a handle along the side. It might be stationary, it might be swing bar. But this shape that we know a casket today was developed in America in the 1930s and 1940s. And the reason is because of steel production. This shape is very easy to make when you're pressing steel. The wood manufacturers moved away from this vintage design that has a much flatter top, a much more stable wood joinery, to this shape to compete with steel. This is a truly unique and very American design. The wood version pursued the market that the steel version was creating. Every one of these caskets is somebody's mom or dad's casket, and it should be an emotional experience for us. I'm still afraid of death. I don't want to think about when it's going to happen. It's not just a regular job for us. This is very important work for all of us.
That was Jonas Zahn of the Northwoods Casket Company. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
We've just heard about sustainably built caskets, which can be a part of a new movement highlighting natural or green burials. Joining us now to tell us more about green burials is Shed Farley, coordinator at the Natural Path Sanctuary in Verona. Shed, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, first off, let's define green burial. What is it?
So a green burial, and the first thing I should mention is that there are different shades of green. In general, a green burial is trying to avoid the toxic materials that come with embalming and also the overuse of resources in the burial itself. So that means vaults are eliminated in our form of green burial. However, there are other cemeteries that do still use vaults. And it's more of an intent to leave as small an imprint on the environment as we can do.
Well, walk us through it. Would you, if someone is interested in planning for themselves a green burial or someone comes with a loved one, what might that green burial look like? How would it take shape?
In general, it's much like how you would plan for a conventional burial at a conventional cemetery. Most of our clients go through a funeral home because a funeral home in our modern society, families are often all spread out all over the country. And a funeral home has the ability through refrigeration to hold a body indefinitely if they were not to be embalmed. So most of our clients also have a very keen interest in the environment, and they'll come to me either before because they've heard of us and they'd like to tour the cemetery and purchase in advance, pre-need. But often they'll come afterwards, the survivors saying, my father passed away or my mother passed away and knew about you and wished to be buried here. So the funeral homes in the Madison area are all of them, every one of them, right on board with what we do. So they're able to supply the containers, either caskets or shrouds to for the burial. That we will allow, and will transport the body to us. There are other options in Colorado, or one other option, in that families can choose to bypass funeral home and tend to the bodies themselves.
Where did you say that option was?
In Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
Did I say Colorado?
I thought you said Colorado, but I was wanting to
make
sure.
I lived in Colorado for 36 years.
I see. Okay, so that is available here in Wisconsin.
It is.
And in terms of cremation, a lot of people, I think, historically have thought cremation is an environmentally conscious choice to make there. You don't have the big casket, which will linger in the ground for a long time. How do you weigh cremation?
So cremation is, first of all, many people say this. Many people have come to me and said, I'm going to go one greener than you, and I'm going to be cremated. Sometimes you have to push people who are environmentally conscious and aware another half inch. And all I have to say is, how much fuel does it take to heat a body to 1,700 degrees for 4 hours? It takes an incredible amount of fuel, and with emissions from the crematoriums and the use of that fuel and the growing popularity of cremations, it adds nothing good to our environment. However, I will also say that it is still better than what happens at a conventional cemetery.
Now, a lot of people are drawn to the natural path sanctuary. I think part of the green burial and the grounds as well are part of it. What does it look like? What appeals to people?
So each natural cemetery has a different geography, a different topography. ours is located at my father's and mother's former home. And it's a 43-acre property, 25 of which are designated to the natural cemetery. We do have some open meadow areas and some formerly oak savanna areas, but most of our acres are wooded acres. So it's literally being buried in or close to the woods. And the paths have been put there by my father so that he and my mother could just walk through the woods years ago when they lived there, not that many years ago. And we've kept the same paths and have plotted our grave sites around it. The intent is to keep that very natural wooded look or meadow look. So we have certain limitations on the markers that people can use, and a variety of other things. We do not maintain the land like a conventional cemetery would, as far as mowing lawns or anything like that. We really want the woods to remain as natural as possible.
Now, this is family land for you, which makes me curious how you got involved in this. Why did you decide to donate this land, not to mention your own life, your own career path, to green burials?
So that really began... start by saying both my parents were very active in many social issues, including the environment. In 2009, my mother died, and she had lived in this house for 25 years or so and loved it. And we decided to bury her naturally on the property. Because we were a rural property, we could get permission from the town of Springdale, where we're located, and we did so. We buried her, we wrapped her in a cotton blanket, and dug the hole with friends and family and lowered her in and buried her. So from there, it was obvious. We asked Dad, what happens next when you die? We have to sell the place. And that's what started the whole Farley Center and Natural Past Sanctuary.
So this wasn't something that you had set out to do with your life. It's something that sort of grew out of who your family was.
So as you already know, I'm from Colorado. I've been a general contractor home builder in Colorado and have been for 32 years. The house that my parents lived in was my first general contracting experience. I've been doing that a long time and had always wanted to do this kind of work, and this one fell into my lap, more or less.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, you also offer workshops at Natural Path Sanctuary. What would people learn at those?
So workshops is basically going into much more detail about what we are talking about now, what constitutes a natural burial, why it's good for the earth or not as harmful to the earth as conventional burials, and the traditions and reasons for it. The workshop itself, it's kind of how you define workshops, is we don't do any actual work, but
you're learning
but it's
things.
More of an educational.
Shed, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
That was Shed Farley, coordinator at the Natural Path Sanctuary in Verona, talking about green burial practices.
Coming up, the owners of USA Today have made an offer to buy Tribune Publishing, a big media group. We'll talk about what these big media acquisitions can mean for news consumers. I'm Rob Farrakh.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 7, it's this week's edition of Reveal. Tonight, Reveal takes a look at the toll of gun violence in the country, who's documenting the damage, and how lives can be saved. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, an offer made to one of the nation's oldest media companies was made public today. Tribune Publishing, the parent company of major daily newspapers like the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, received an offer to be purchased by its biggest competitor, Gannett Media.
Gannett made a private offer to buy Tribune Publishing for $815 million. To put that in perspective, Gannett offered Tribune a little over $12 per share for stock that's been struggling at about $7 as of late. Gannett owns major papers like USA Today. It recently acquired the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and owns other papers in Wisconsin. If the offer goes through, it would be one of Gannett's biggest acquisitions yet.
Here to tell us more about the potential deal between the major media companies and what it means for the newspaper industry is Jim Warren. He's the former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune and currently the chief media writer at Poynter Institute and contributing editor for the New York Daily News, also contributor to Vanity Fair. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure on a pretty notable day, as I said, on the north side of Chicago, not just because it's like 75, 80 degrees, and we've like whisked right past spring for one day, but also because of this deal, which clearly was a surprise, I think, first and foremost to the management, the new management of Tribune Publishing, and a 49-year-old, until now sort of little-known tech executive, Mini Mogul, who had sold a software healthcare imaging firm to IBM for $1 billion last fall, and then parlayed his involvement in the Chicago Sun-Times into basically taking over the Tribune Company in a somewhat surprise deal itself just 2 months ago. So he's been in charge basically for 2 months, and now what is essentially a hostile offer from Gannett, hostile because, of, as best I can tell, they called and said, hey, let's talk, and he wasn't interested, so bingo.
Right, this has been a roller coaster ride because this offer was first made on April 12th, but the public found out today. Why did it go public today?
Well, it went public today because Gannett said clearly, okay, enough's enough. We wanted to be nice. We wanted to sit down, talk, look at your financials on a private basis, and then likely make an offer. And apparently Tribune Publishing, not interested. So Gannett says, okay, no more nice guys. We're going public with this offer, which, as your colleague said, $12 a share for a stock that had gone into the dumper was about $20 a share a year ago, and given the state of the whole newspaper industry, has fallen. So this is going to be, it's going to be, A, interesting to see if Tribune Publishing, led by the tech executive Michael Farrow, now does whatever it sees fit to try to rebut this, and whether it, whether the shareholders, other major shareholders, say, wait a second, $12 for stuff that's been in the dumper, I'll take that.
Right, that's a pretty aggressive offer from Gannett there on the stock options alone. What does that mean for the shareholders who are going to be weighing this offer right now?
Well, shareholders, just imagine you've got 1,000 shares or 100,000 shares that are right now in the market have been valued around 7 or 8. Somebody's offering you $12. I suspect the strategy would be a willingness to go a little higher than that. If circumstances play out that way, maybe somebody comes out of the woodwork and says, hey, we want to get involved in a bidding for the company. So I wouldn't take the $12 necessarily as the last offer, but you can just put yourself in the place of major institutional shareholders that have a lot of stocks. Say you got 1,000, 2,000 shares and someone's offering you 50% more than it's been valued. You'll take that seriously.
It's interesting. Gannett Media seems like it's kind of on a roll. It just acquired, for instance, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel here in Wisconsin, and you've got it looking to acquire Tribune Publishing not shortly, just sort of shortly on the heels of that offer there. What's with the speed of this offer, do you think?
Well, that's a really good question. The deal for Milwaukee, which was a big, big, big deal for Gannett, came after a period of time when the then CEO of Tribune Publishing, a guy named Jack Griffin, he himself was kicking the tires about a Milwaukee deal. He saw, you know, obvious synergies, printing and otherwise, and having big paper in Chicago, the big paper in Milwaukee. He apparently didn't want to buy the entire company, and then Gannett swoops in and buys it. The deal was consummated, you know, legally 2 weeks ago. It's still way too early, Veronica, to know what the impact will actually be on a city which, like a lot of cities, has been accustomed to decades and decades and decades of local ownership. And now you're going to have sort of, you know, faraway chain company owning them. So it's too early. I gather. Folks in the newsroom there are sort of a little bit wary, but, you know, to use a, you know, cliche that one uses in all walks of life, sort of cautiously optimistic at this point. Early responses I've gotten from folks at the existing Tribune Publishing, the flagship now is the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune and their 9 other papers, notably the Baltimore Sun and papers in Fort Lauderdale and Orlando. The early sort of unscientific survey I've done is, you know, people are very, very, very anxious. Gannett has been traditionally associated with smaller town, sort of more middle brow type papers, not associated, say, with, you know, A-list great New York Times, Washington Post-like journalism. And so this is a really, you know, going into Milwaukee, Chicago and L.A. is a big step up in class for them in many ways, and I'll be interested to see how they perform.
We're talking with Jim Warren right now, chief media writer at the Poynter Institute, talking about the offer recently from Gannett Media to buy its biggest competitor, Tribune Publishing, parent company of the Chicago Tribune and the L.A. Times. And, Jim, as you were just outlining there, some of Gannett's holdings, what happens to the scope of their brand and their reach if they acquire Tribune brands like the Chicago Tribune and the L.A. Times? How much clout do they have?
Well, you know, they have, I don't know how you put it, Veronica, they have more clout in a dramatically diminishing industry. I mean, you know, just think about the price that they're paying, just over $800 million for the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and 9 other papers. It wasn't too long ago, maybe 10 years ago, it would have cost you at least $1 billion alone to buy the L.A. Times, $1 billion alone to buy the Chicago Tribune. But it just shows how dramatic the decline has been, spurred by a lot of factors, notably the Internet. You know, the decline in value of these properties has been huge. Now, as I said, they're now stepping up into a different league, a higher profile. They had, I think, traditionally, institutionally, been a little bit wary of big markets. They, did by, some accounts, rather brilliantly, certainly financially, in small markets. I mean, they're, in fact, I think they're the state where they've got the most papers now is Wisconsin, Green Bay, and elsewhere. And so I think they felt more at home in smaller and mid-sized markets. They had a business model in which, by and large, the publisher was king. The editor was really not so significant, and that's very different than you've had traditionally at places like Milwaukee and Chicago and Los Angeles and New York and Washington, where there was, sort of at times a fractious, but ultimately a real sort of partnership of equals between editors and publishers. And some would argue that the resulting quality of those papers was a result of that, and the fact that in the business, at least, Gannett is not synonymous with that sort of quality. It has something to do with the business structure, which they placed upon a lot of their papers.
What do we know about what might happen to reporting, to journalism, when you get some of these big media companies consolidating?
Well, I think by and large what you've seen is, fairly dramatic decrease in the size of newsrooms, an attempt to consolidate lots of business functions, whether it's marketing or sales, distribution or printing and things like that, and that the, consensus would be that journalistically it has not been very good for, old media newspapers who have but then, I think, exacerbated their problems with a lot of self-inflicted wounds, most notably not shifting quickly enough to the Internet as their once very lucrative print circulation headed south very quickly, and now being in the position of, sort of desperately and, I think, too late in many cases trying to get people to pay for online content, which arguably is not as strong as the content that they once upon a time produced.
If I'm a news consumer, I'm on the ground in Los Angeles or Chicago or Milwaukee for that matter, how do you expect what I'm reading in the morning online or in the paper to change after a merger like this one with Gannett?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think that Gannett itself is 100% sure. They've made some big executive changes just in the last month or so, and one of the things they're trying to figure out is how they can consolidate journalistically in a smart way. For instance, how their Washington Bureau and how their investigative folks in D.C. can produce stuff that folks in Milwaukee and elsewhere might find of interest. There's a sense that they have not done a very good job with that, at least at a high journalistic level. So I think it's it'll be a challenge, but for folks who are accustomed to traditions of, great local investigative reporting, and, as a Pulitzer judge in a bunch of different years, having sat at the table and looked at great stuff from Milwaukee, I know that they have been able in the last decade to produce just consistently terrific stuff, even with huge cost constraints on them. I think for the consumer on the ground at some of these other places, there would be reason for concern, but, of course, that's a little bit ironic since the larger problem in the industry is that there are fewer and fewer people on the ground, Veronica, who really care about the local newspaper.
We're talking with Jim Warren right now, former managing editor at the Chicago Tribune, current chief media writer at the Poynter Institute, talking about a recent offer from Gannett Media to buy its biggest competitor, Tribune Publishing.
We want to hear from you. How do you feel about bigger media companies like Gannett acquiring other newspapers? If you're a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reader, did anything change for you when it was bought out by Gannett Media? Are you still reading the newspaper in the old-fashioned paper version, or do you follow your local newspaper's web incarnation? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got an article by Jim linked there. And do you see bad news in media consolidation? Do you see fewer competing media organizations affecting you as a consumer of news? Again, call in at 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation with Jim Warren, former managing editor at the Chicago Tribune and currently the chief media writer at Poynter Institute. And we're talking about an unsolicited offer that the owners of the Chicago Tribune and LA Times recently got from Gannett Media, a potential deal to buy Tribune Publishing for $815 million.
That's Gannett as in USA Today, and it's made its presence known in Wisconsin. It now has the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to go along with a number of other Gannett, Wisconsin papers. We want to know what this looks like from where you are sitting and where you are reading. Are newspapers still a part of your life in print version, or do you follow one of the newspapers in your community online or a national paper? Or does it matter if it's a newspaper website versus any other news source? And do you worry? Do you think about mergers between major news sources? Do you worry about how that'll affect the news that you get, the news you read? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jim, if we look at a merger like this, big stakes here, companies taking over many papers across the country. If we've got this winnowed pool of people who delivered the news, what happens to diversity and competition in the news industry?
Well, I think you know the answer, Veronica. You have less and less. I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, long ago you had the depth of most two or three newspaper towns. They had this dramatic consolidation, and you know you're going to have less on the traditional local level now. Whether some of the big national brands, you know, the Foxes of the world and the BuzzFeeds of the world and the Gawkers of the world and the Huffington Post of the world, find an economic model where it's worth their while to do local stuff. You know, I don't know. I mean, you've got fairly feisty online local news operation in Chicago and New York called, you know, DNA Info, which does a nice job, but it's not exactly offering huge competition at this point to either the existing papers, the Tribune or the Sun-Times. And for your information, and you know, I didn't exactly know this. Just looking at the list, Wisconsin clearly is Gannett's biggest state. I mean, there's the Post Crescent in Appleton, the Reporter in Fond du Lac, the Green Bay Press Gazette, the Herald Times Reporter, the Marshfield News Herald, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Oshkosh Northwestern, Sheboygan Press, Stevens Point Journal, Wausau Daily Herald, and the Daily Tribune Wisconsin Rapids. They've got a pretty big, footprint in the state.
So, Jim, I want to get to our callers, and we've got some, but I want to follow up on that first, just briefly. Why Wisconsin? Why has Gannett chosen to stake such a big claim here in Wisconsin?
Oh, I don't know the history of their ownership of a lot of these properties. They're big in a whole lot of states, and, big in Florida, a lot of papers in New York, a few more in Wisconsin, but you know, their business model is based on small and mid-sized markets, squeezing a whole lot of costs out of things, running things very frugally. And, you know, one of the reasons they're able to make this bid is that they've got one of the best balance sheets in the newspaper industry. A lot of other folks are saddled with huge debt. They are not, because on the financial side, they've been, pretty shrewd folks.
Let's get to our callers now. Bob is with us in Oshkosh. Bob, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I read online Monday through Friday and get it delivered to the Oshkosh Northwestern on Saturday and Sunday. I find that since the acquisition of the Journal Sentinel, we get very limited local writing. This past weekend, I don't even know if there was an article in the front section that was written from a local perspective.
All right, Bob, thank you for that perspective there. Bob saying he's seeing a winnowing of local reporting. It sounds like that could be something you were looking at as a possible consequence, Jim.
Yeah, and it's one of the potential consequences of consolidation in most any industry. And you look at stuff in a particular geographical region, you go, how can I save money? And one way is sort of, one-size-fits-all, mode of operating. And, without seeing the Oshkosh paper, I'll stipulate to what caller said is being right, but it would not surprise me if there, you know, over time has been a greater homogeneity among the papers in a particular geographic region, you know. So why do we both have to cover that, Wisconsin men's basketball game? Why do both papers? We can just have one guy do it for Sentinel and for everybody else. It's, that's the sort of thinking that has prevailed by and large over the last decade.
And Jim, again, just briefly before we get another caller in, kind of running short on time here, but when does this become kind of an antitrust thing that might play out in the courts instead?
I don't think, given where all these papers are, the Tribune Publishing had a problem in the Justice Department, President Obama's Justice Department, nixed a recent attempt for them to buy the big Orange County, California paper, citing their ownership of the papers in Los Angeles and San Diego as essentially raising antitrust questions, because they would have basically owned all the big papers from Los Angeles south of the Mexican border. I don't think, Veronica, you've got a counterpart to that right here in this deal.
Let's go next to John in Cedarburg. John, hello.
Hi. I'm really sorry to see the consolidation of our newsprint and information. It seems to me the Journal and Sentinel used to give differing points of view, and then they became the Journal. Then when they endorsed Walker, I thought they had gone kind of right wing, so I stopped reading them at all. And I know Gannett is, they're pretty right wing. They used to plant articles in northern Wisconsin that were very pro-Iraq war.
And John, I'm going to leave it there. We're just about out of time. But Jim, I want to say thank you to you for joining us. Lots to chew on there.
Hey, pleasure, guys.
That was Jim Warren, former managing editor at the Chicago Tribune, currently the chief media writer at Poynter Institute and contributing editor for the New York Daily News. And he talked to us there about a potential buyout of Tribune Publishing, the owners of Chicago Tribune and the LA Times, by Gannett Media.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a guest says recent Wisconsin budgets have gutted vital state services and a big part of Wisconsin's identity with cuts to UW Extension.
On the 30th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster in Ukraine, we'll hear about a Wisconsin-based effort to help people in that affected region.
And a guest tells us about how difficult it can be to maintain adult friendships. People move away, hard to make new friends. She'll have advice on, in our adult lives, how to make some new friends.
That's all coming up tomorrow, plus a look at the news here on Central Time.
Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 7, a school in Middleton, Wisconsin, is seeing controversy over a Jesus lunch on a public park during school hours. Joy gets two perspectives on that issue. That's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR.
Then we'll talk about the news that candidates Ted Cruz and John Kasich are working together to deny the Republican presidential nomination to Donald Trump, coordinating their efforts in some key primary states. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.